February 14th, and we're going to be done with the chemistry chapter, maybe move on to the next chapter today. So let's just recap what we did last time. What did we look at last time? We finished up lipids, right? So what are the building blocks of a triglyceride?
Three fatty acids
and one glycerol. And you should know how to recognize a fatty acid, whether it's saturated or unsaturated. You should know what glycerol looks like, maybe draw it out. Let's see, what else? So lipids, what's a precursor molecule to testosterone and estrogen?
Steroid.
Yeah, steroid, what's steroid in particular?
Cholesterol.
Yeah, cholesterol. Cholesterol is a precursor molecule. Okay, then we got out of lipids and went into proteins. What's a building block of a protein?
Amino
acid. I didn't tell you that there's about 20 important amino acids that we need in our body, but you know what the building blocks are. What's the building block of tertiary structure? Secondary structure. And what is secondary structure?
Primary.
But no, I'm asking what's a good definition for secondary structure, not a building block. Alpha helix, beta pleated sheet, right, which is a nifty structure within the body of a protein. Okay, and that's pretty good for proteins, I think. So we're going to move on to nucleic acids today. Do we have a test next week? No, we don't. Okay. And well, I usually show the syllabus with a schedule ahead of time, but I'm always pressed for time and it hasn't been loaded in just yet. So, okay. So let's see. Don't forget Monday is a holiday. That's the only other announcement that I want to make, but we don't meet on Monday. So that really is not pertinent to us. Okay, nucleic acids. These are the fourth kind of important biochemicals or biological compounds that we have in our body, right? So they were starting with what? We had carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and this is the fourth one, nucleic acid. And nucleic acids include both deoxyribonucleic acid and ribonucleic acid. This R right here stands for the sugar ribose. So nucleic acids have some building blocks as well that you have to know about, and one of these is going to be a ribose molecule. Okay, and in DNA it's going to be a ribose molecule that is missing one tiny little oxygen atom, and that's going to totally change its characteristics in our body, just that small change in structure. And just like sugars and proteins and even lipids to some extent, we can make big polymers of these repeating units over and over and over again. So if we, here's a building block of a nucleic acid, we call that a nucleotide. Okay, so this is the building block of a nucleic acid. We can put numerous nucleotides together, and how would you do that? How does your body do that? Didn't have to figure out anything new. We looked at it a couple times already. We looked at it three times. The chemical reaction, which you could build this polymer right here with this building block. We can use a dehydration synthesis reaction, okay? So, and you're familiar with that. And when that happens, when we join a couple of these nucleotides together, what else is produced?
Water,
yeah, because it's a dehydration synthesis reaction, or sometimes we call that a condensation. Okay, you guys got to review your notes from beginning to end. Okay, so this ribose sugar is a 5-carbon sugar, right, which is unlike what kind of sugars that we looked at so far. Yeah, monosaccharide. Well, I tell you what, ribose is a monosaccharide, but it's a 5-carbon sugar, which makes it different than glucose, because glucose is a 6-carbon, okay, and fructose, which is a 6-carbon, right? Okay, so this nucleotide has a sugar, namely this 5-carbon sugar right here. It's got a phosphate group right here, so that's a PO4 group, and then some kind of big biomolecule that we call a base because it's basic, and it contains some nitrogen atoms in there, so we call it a nitrogenous base. So these are the three components that make up a nucleotide: the base, the sugar, which is going to be ribose or some derivation of ribose, and a phosphate group. And this nucleotide can be put together to make this big long chain of nucleotides, which we're going to call a nucleic acid. And there are two kinds, right? DNA and RNA. And the bases that we have in DNA are guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. Those are the chemical compounds that are added to the ribose sugar in just this location, kind of sticking off to the side. And probably from now on, I'm not going to call this thing guanine and this thing thymine and this thing cytosine. I'm just going to say GTCA if I mean those chemical compounds, right? And everybody uses that same vernacular. All right, so what do we have right here? And these are the only four bases that we have in DNA. It's kind of a redundant slide. Okay, DNA, let me flip. Here we go. DNA doesn't exist as a single strand of nucleotides. DNA always is found in a double strand. So here is one strand on the left, here is another strand on the right. And think of this as being a ladder, and here are the steps within the ladder, and these are the handrails. So I would like for you to know what parts of a nucleotide make up the steps and which part make up the handrails. So you can see a phosphate group and a sugar. A phosphate group and a sugar. Phosphate group all the way down the line right here. So these are the handrails that make up the backbone of a DNA molecule. Okay, and don't forget, DNA is always double-stranded. It doesn't really exist in nature as we see it as a stepladder because it twists like this. Right, we call that a double helix. That's a nice typical structure of DNA. And it just so happens that the shape of cytosine matches up perfectly with guanine right here. The shape of C matches up with the shape of G, so that when you make this alpha helix, they can pair together, they can fit together, right? That allows this alpha helix to form. All right, so C can't pair up with another C because it's not the right shape. It can't pair up with A, can't pair up with T, because it has the wrong shape. So C always has to pair up with G. And what does G always have to pair up with? C, yeah, the reverse is true as well, right? So it just employs some symmetry. All right, T can only pair up with A because it has the right shape, but not only just the right shape, but also the correct number of hydrogen bonds, right? So I see three hydrogen bonds between C and G, and I see only two between T and A. And I don't think I really want you to know that. I don't want you to know the shapes and where these things come from, but I do want you to know, right, that these four nitrogenous bases are what we find in DNA. In particular, pay attention to thymine right here, or the T. Only DNA has a thymine nucleotide, or that nitrogenous base in the nucleotide. So this pairing right here is what we call the law of complementary base pairing. That is just a rule that is always followed. Okay, so here we have these two strands. Those two strands are joined together by these hydrogen bonds. And can you, let's talk about bonds. How many bonds do you know about now? Okay, let's count them out. Give me an example. Covalent is one. Ionic is one. Hydrogen is one. And van der Waals forces. Okay, so four. And probably some people don't even consider van der Waals forces a chemical bond, but we're going to consider it in class. And you told me in the correct order in terms of strength. So hydrogen bonds are pretty weak, and that is used to hold these DNA strands together, right? Which also means what? That this molecule can be separated, the strands can be separated very easily. It can be unzipped and then it can be put back together again. It can be taken apart, put back together again, without costing the cell a whole lot of energy. All right, so this is DNA. You can tell it's DNA two ways, because it's double-stranded over here, and because it has thymine. That's a good way to know that it is DNA. All right, so remember what the backbone of the DNA molecule is. It's a sugar phosphate, and in DNA it's deoxyribose, and then like the steps pointing to the inside, those are the nitrogenous bases. Let me go back to this slide right here. We talked about it. Okay, so here you can see now the particular shapes of guanine and cytosine. So here is a large base on one side that's got a base pair with a small one on the other side, and in particular cytosine, in order for that double helix to form. Okay, so I don't think I need to talk about those slides anymore. Okay, let's look at RNA just a little bit. It has nucleotides that make it up, and it can become a long polymer via a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, but it's never double-stranded, or it might be double-stranded only for a short distance. These RNA molecules will coil around on each other, sort of like the amino acids in a protein. Okay, but it doesn't form a double helix like DNA is. does. So you can tell just by looking at that molecule if it's DNA or RNA. There's another way of knowing. And that's because in RNA, right, we use the form of ribose. This is the complete form of ribose with an OH in all, each of these locations right here. That makes the ribose sugar. But if we remove this oxygen atom from this position, right, we call this deoxyribose. This is the sugar that is incorporated into the nucleotides for a DNA molecule. So you should be able to see the difference between a ribose molecule and deoxyribose. Right? And deoxyribose makes DNA, ribose makes RNA. All right, so what is your impression? Is that a big, huge, major change in this molecule and this ribose in terms of just the overall structure? My impression is no, but the function is huge. That change in structure means a huge change in function. So that's sort of a trick question. Okay, the other thing that makes RNA a little bit different is that in DNA, whenever there's a thymine, it's going to be substituted with a different kind of base, which we call uracil. And you can see that thymine and uracil almost look identical to each other as well. Just the difference in this methyl group right here. And that makes all the difference between RNA and DNA. The other thing that I want you to know is RNA is single-stranded. That's on this slide. Let's talk about where we find these things. DNA, as long as the cell is not undergoing mitosis, DNA you find only in the nucleus. And RNA you can find in the nucleus and also in the cytoplasm. And we're going to see why that is in a little bit, maybe in the next chapter. Okay, so that's another distinction between RNA and DNA. Okay, different kinds of RNA. There are three kinds, and there's some subcategories of these as well. Right? And these different kinds of RNA allow a cell to build a protein. So the first kind we have right here is messenger RNA. So let's consider this for a second. How would you build a protein? What do you need? What's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid. And how would you go about building a protein from a whole bunch of amino acids? You just make a big long string of amino acids, right? We call that the primary structure, and that's how you go about building a protein, as long as you have all those amino acids right there. So the sequence of amino acids in a protein is sort of like how you spell that protein out. But the letters are amino acids instead of letters in our vocabulary. Okay, so the cell has to know what amino acid to put in what location. And that is defined in the DNA, which then that information is transferred into RNA. And this messenger RNA can tell the cell how to put these amino acids together in just the right sequence to build the protein that the cell needs. All right, so different combinations or different sequences of nucleotides in the string of messenger RNA will tell the cell how to put amino acids together in just the right primary sequence to make that particular protein. Right, and if we change the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein, that's like changing the letters when we spell a word. And what does that do to the meaning of the word? It changes it drastically, right? So the same thing for that protein. If we change the primary sequence in a protein, then the function of that protein is going to have just a totally different meaning inside the cell. So that's why we call this messenger RNA. It takes information from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. And in the cytoplasm, then that information can be used to build a protein together by putting amino acids in the right order. Right? It spells out the proper word for us. All right, so what is the building block again for a protein? Amino acid, that's right. So we're going to have all kinds of amino acids floating around inside the cell. And that messenger RNA is going to need a specific amino acid to put into the protein at a particular time. So there is another kind of RNA molecule that will look around the whole cell, grab an amino acid, bring it to where the protein is made, right, and have it inserted in the right location. That kind of RNA is a tRNA. And it's really called a transfer RNA because it's transferring amino acids around from the cytoplasm to the workbench where this protein is being made. Another way of thinking of tRNA, and I always remember this before transfer. Should I tell you? I mean, it's really silly. Yeah? Okay, I think of it as a taxi RNA. which is T again. All right, so this taxi RNA is going to grab one particular amino acid, bring it to the workbench so that it can be incorporated into a protein. The workbench is made out of some proteins, but also different kinds of ribosomal RNA. So RNA is, this rRNA makes the workbench where a protein is going to be made. So here's the workbench. In order for this workbench to make a protein, it's got to have the correct spelling of that primary sequence of amino acids, and that's in the RNA molecule. It also needs those amino acids, and those are brought to the ribosome via this taxi RNA. Okay, so those are the three main kinds of RNA that we're really interested in. Oh, wow, that's the last slide already? How come I didn't talk faster last time? Okay, so to recap, DNA is found only in the nucleus. It has thymine and is double-stranded. RNA, on the other hand, is single-stranded. You can find it in the nucleus, but where it really does its job is in the cytoplasm. Another difference, and this is pretty important, the ribosugar, which is a building block of a nucleotide, if it's DNA, it's missing an oxygen just in this location right here. All right, so if we go back a previous slide here, okay, here is the basic, the building blocks for a nucleotide. We've got a phosphate group, a 5-carbon sugar, and a base. Okay, how many bases do you know about right now? Okay, four. You got G, C, A, T. They base pair together in DNA. But guess what? There's even one more that you find in RNA. And what's that? Yeah, don't forget about uracil. Okay? You don't find uracil in DNA. You only find it in RNA. And in RNA, you never find a thymine. So that's a really good check on to whether you know if it's DNA or RNA. All right, let's go back to this. These building blocks again. So here are the bases. Here's a 5-carbon sugar. How many 5-carbon sugars do you know about that can make a nucleotide? Right? It's either deoxyribose, missing an oxygen right here, or it could be a ribose, which has this oxygen just in this location. But in every case, it's going to be this 5-carbon sugar, and it's based on ribose, right? The ribose sugar, and this phosphate group is always the same. All right, so I just want you to know that there's a difference, okay, in RNA and DNA right here. All right, so let's say there is an oxygen right here in this location on this ribose, and we can say this is G. What kind of nucleotide is this? What's it going to be used for if there's an oxygen right here? DNA or RNA? RNA. Okay, and if it's missing this oxygen, it's going to be used to make DNA. Just that's the really simple change right there. All right, so we can call this, if it has an oxygen, a ribonucleotide, because it's used to make RNA. If it's missing this oxygen right here, we would have to call it what? A deoxyribonucleotide, because it's missing that oxygen. It's what's going to be used to make an RNA. Okay, so in this lecture, we went over a whole bunch of stuff, and maybe I have a cool thing to work with right here. You do have it in Blackboard as a video, but we're going to just use it in class right now. Ah, okay, close your eyes. Okay, open them. I wanted to load this up without you seeing what was going on. So now we're going to practice naming some of these chemical compounds. Right, some of them are big polymers, some of them are building blocks of the biochemicals that we looked at. And so this video, which is narrated by me, is in Blackboard, and it's sort of interactive. A lot of videos are not interactive. It's like listening to a lecture, but it's sort of interactive because you'll see the chemical, and then about 2 or 3 seconds later, I'll say the name. So when you watch the video, say the name out loud before I say it. Okay, then you say it, and then I say it, and see if they're the same thing. All right, so it is a little bit interactive. You can control correct yourself. All right, so the first time through, I don't want to go too fast. What is this thing right here? Let's talk about this. It is a nucleotide, right? Because here we see a nitrogenous base, we see a phosphate group, and then here we see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons, so that's a ribose. What kind of ribose is it? It's a true ribose. It's not a deoxyribose. So this nucleotide right here is what? A ribonucleotide, because it's going to be used to make a ribose polymer because of this oxygen right here. Ribonucleotide when you see this thing. All right, and these are the building blocks of a nucleotide: nitrogenous base, sugar, and phosphate. What part of this molecule right here makes the handrails of a DNA molecule? Okay, phosphate and sugar. Yep, and then there's gonna be another phosphate and sugar, and these are the things that are sticking toward the inside of the alpha helix, the bases. Consider them like the steps in that spiral staircase. All right, so that's one molecule. And then what do we have here? We just have a rest station. Okay, we don't have to do anything with this. Okay? But the next slide has something. Okay, it's highlighted. I don't want you to tell me hydrocarbon. I want to know what the name of this functional group is. That is a sulfhydryl group. Okay, and that's all what you really have to know, but it's found on cysteine, and if these sulfhydryl groups pair up together when a protein folds, they can make a nice covalent bond and really stabilize a bend in a protein molecule. So they're pretty important. So instead of a hydrogen, this is a sulfhydryl group. All right, and then another rest station, and then we have this. What's this? What kind of group is that? Amino group, and it's used to make what kind of thing that you knew about years ago? Proteins, because it makes up a amino acid, right? So you're going to see this kind of beast on an amino acid someplace. And then what do we got? What is this? That's a carboxylic acid or carboxyl group, right? It's acidic because this proton can hop off of this molecule and then be a hydrogen ion floating in solution. So when this compound donates this hydrogen ion to the solution, what is it really? That's a definition of an acid, right? So a carboxyl group is highly acidic because of this proton right here. Then we got another rest station, but we won't spend too much time there. Here is a phosphate group, okay? Inorganic phosphate with these four oxygens here. These hydrogens can also jump off of the molecule and become protons or hydrogen ions floating in solution. So this also is an acidic group as well, okay? So sometimes maybe we call that a phosphoric acid, but inorganic phosphate is good. What is this thing right here? I want to know the general name, not the specific name. It's a monosaccharide, but it's kind of cool because it has six. It doesn't have five. It's not ribose. It's just a different kind of monosaccharide. What can you make with monosaccharides? You can make disaccharides, right? And you can make glycogen as well, which is what? A polysaccharide. Hundreds or thousands of these molecules added together with what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. What is this thing here? Fatty acid, because here's that carboxyl group at the end, and it's just a big long hydrocarbon chain. What can you tell me about this big long hydrocarbon chain right here? What world does it belong to? Lipid world, that's right. It is hydrophobic, right? Because it's all nonpolar. So you should be able to think of all those things when you analyze these structures now. Okay, and then here, what's going on here? Dehydration synthesis reaction, because here you can see water being produced, right? And what are the building blocks that we're looking at? One, glycerol, right? Make sure you can label that glycerol. And then we have three of these things that look identical to each other. And these are, here's a carboxyl group, so it's going to be some kind of acid. Here's that long hydrocarbon chain. So these are three fatty acids. We clomp on three fatty acids to the glycerol, and we get a triglyceride, right? And don't forget about these three waters. Now, let's flip this arrow back. Can we flip it the other way? Does your body do that? Yeah. Absolutely, it does. And what kind of reaction is used to go the reverse way? A hydrolysis reaction, and for that, not only do you need a triglyceride, but you need water. All right, so water is pretty cool. It's the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it participates in many reactions in your body. So it's a biochemical as a result of that. Okay, what do we got here? Another monosaccharide. You don't have to tell me the specific name. It's a six-carbon sugar, but it has a little bit different arrangement. Kind of looks like a ribose, but it isn't, because we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These little corners right here just represent a carbon atom. Right, so it's not really a ribose, because there's a carbon sticking down over here and there's one up over here as well. This carbon really should be right over this little line, but that's kind of a picky point. Okay, what is this? That's a micelle. When you look at this, you should know what makes this outer ring right here. What are these molecules? Water. And what kind of molecule is water? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar, okay? And then this molecule here is your favorite one. This is a phospholipid. This group, which is represented like a big head right here, what is this? That's a phosphate inorganic phosphate group, and that's highly polar, so it likes to associate with water. And these tails over here are the tails of a fatty acid. These are nonpolar, and so they like to stick together, and right, they don't like to be anywhere near water. So this thing just kind of automatically forms. So say my cell, and what do we got here? What are all of these? Yeah, these are all steroids. The first one is what it makes all of these others down here. This first one really is cholesterol, right? You don't have to know that, but you should at least recognize these as all steroids. And here's another lipid. That's a hint. What kind of lipid? It's an unsaturated fatty acid. Oh, did we look at a fatty acid before? Oh, we did. Okay, we'll cover it. What kind was it? Use your memory. It was a saturated fatty acid, right? Because there were no double bonds. Every carbon had two hydrogens on it. Okay, what is this thing here? It's an amino acid, right? Just by looking at it, you can tell. Okay, and this R group just means that there can be different functional groups added to the alpha carbon to change the nature of this amino acid. And generally, there are 20 different kinds of substitutions that can take place here, which then the amino acid is going to be different as a result. All right, but recognize that as an amino acid. And what is this thing? Yeah, that's your favorite molecule again. Here's glycerol, and carbon 1 and 2 have a fatty acid added to it. Okay, and then carbon number 3 has this phosphatidyl group right here, which contains a phosphate, so we call this a phospholipid. This is the lipid part, here's the phosphate part, and all of this right here is very polar. You can see some electrical charges, so this is the part that likes to dissolve in water or be associated with water, and then here is the part that is nonpolar, doesn't want to have anything to do with water. This is really what makes your lipid world inside you, these long fatty acids when they all join together. Okay. These things are derivatives of fatty acids. And what would you call these? All of these things? You don't have to know specifically each one by name, but as a class, you would call these prostaglandins. So make sure you can recognize this as prostaglandin. And then here, aha, don't be tricked. It's a helix, okay, but it's not DNA, right? This is just a alpha helix. All these are just amino acids, and it's kind of stabilized with these hydrogen bonds just in the right location. And so what kind of structure is this in terms of when you analyze a protein? Yeah, it's secondary structure. What's the building block for this structure? Yeah, the primary structure, which is just a sequence of amino acids. And it's if it has the right sequence, then it forms this alpha helix. What's another kind of secondary structure? Beta pleated sheet, I don't have a picture, but you could Google that pretty easily, I'm sure. Okay, so what would this question be? What's the nature of this structure? Okay, secondary structure, you would say. Or maybe I could ask you, what's the building block of this thing? And then you'd say primary structure of a protein. All right, what is this thing here? It's a nucleotide, but you also have to tell me what kind of nucleotide. It's missing this oxygen, so it's what, a deoxyribonucleotide, because here's a ribose, but it's missing this oxygen. So tell me about the possible bases that could exist in this location right here. Okay, so you got A, A, G, but let's do it in terms of pairs. Which ones pair up? AT, so is T what you find in DNA?
Yes.
Absolutely, okay. And then what's the other pair? CG, right? You could say GC, I don't care, either way, all right. So then you know this is a building block for making DNA. All right, what's this functional group? Hydroxyl group, and here I see three hydroxyl groups. One of the cool things about a hydroxyl group is that they can be used in a dehydration synthesis reaction to make polymers. All right, so this is half of what makes that dehydration synthesis reaction work. Here is a carbonyl group. And then what is this thing here? It's a nucleotide, but what kind? Ribonucleotide, okay, for making RNA. So I think we're all through with that. Let's go through it maybe two more times. All right, so what is this? Sulfhydryl group. Yeah, don't look at me. That's what I tell students during practicums all the time. Don't look at me. I can look at you, but you can't look at me. Same thing for this test here. All right, so look at the slide. What do we got there? Amino acid. And here is a carboxyl group. Okay, phosphate group. Okay, is that too fast? Maybe people in the front row? Okay. All right, what do we got here? Monosaccharide. And then this is a saturated fatty acid. Here is a dehydration synthesis reaction. Maybe you can remember the glycerol, three fatty acids, going to make a triglyceride plus three waters. Right here is another monosaccharide. Here is a micelle. And then we have steroids, unsaturated fatty acid, okay, amino acid. You should be able to analyze that molecule, see the amino group and carboxyl group. And then here is a phospholipid. Make sure in your mind you can draw that out somehow here. Our prostaglandins, just a modified fatty acid. That was alpha helix. And what does it make in a protein? What does it define in a protein? What does an alpha helix define? The secondary structure of that protein. Okay. I don't know if that's a good way of saying it. What is that? Deoxyribonucleotide, right? And you can tell me the three parts of that. What's that? Hydroxyl group, glycerol, really nice. Here is a carbonyl group, and then a ribonucleotide, because it has that oxygen right here. Okay, sulfhydryl group, are we doing this a second time? Yeah, we are, okay. So hopefully nobody got sick or seasick looking at that, because we flipped through it pretty quick. But you know what, we could look through it again probably in just 2 minutes right now. But you can practice that in Blackboard because you can download the video, all right? And all of these pictures are in your textbook, so I don't give you the individual JPEGs. But you should know all of those for the test, each one of those things. Okay. Sign-in sheet is going around. So let's now start the next chapter in your syllabus. What's the next chapter that we're going to do? Six. So it's a little bit out of sequence. Lecture PowerPoints. All right, interactions between cells and something about the extracellular environment. So we're going to actually look at the extracellular environment first. Pointer options, arrow options, make that visible. Okay, so in this chapter, now we know some chemistry, some basic chemistry. In this chapter, we're going to learn some specific physical chemistry. Physical chemistry describes how chemicals work with each other, okay, and how these chemicals move across a plasma membrane, for instance. We're going to look at that. So let's talk about the extracellular environment, but let's define what it is. What is the extracellular environment? It's inside your body, but it's outside your cells, okay? So it's all that fluid that's outside of cells, but still contained in your body. We have intracellular component, right, makes up 67% of your total water, okay, is inside cells. So most of it is inside cells, and the rest is outside of cells that we're going to call the extracellular compartment, or ECF, right? So that leaves 33% outside of cells. And let's then analyze the two parts that make up this extracellular compartment. 80% of it is what we call interstitial fluid. It's outside of cells, and it's in between cells, right? It's contained within different tissues, and if it's a connective tissue, remember, connective tissue has ground substance as well as fibers, and that ground substance holds water in that extracellular compartment, okay? That's 80% of the ECF. 20% is found in blood in the form of plasma, right? So blood has basically two components to it. It has plasma and then formed elements, which are all the cells. That plasma is making up 20% of the extracellular compartment. Okay, so make sure you know the difference between interstitial fluid and plasma. Those are the two components in extracellular fluids. All right, oh, this is what I was talking about. So let's look at this. I see a layer of something right here. What kind of tissue is that? It's even labeled. Rats, too bad. It's an epithelium, right, because it's covering a surface. And you should probably be able to tell me what kind of epithelium that is. Right, it's a simple, it looks kind of cuboidal to me. It's a nice, it's for sure simple, and we'll say cuboidal epithelium. And right underneath the epithelium is a basement membrane. Attached to the plasma membrane of this epithelium, there are protein filaments, microtubules that stick down and adhere to the basement membrane, but also adhere to other kinds of proteins that we find in the matrix of this connective tissue, right? And so this is another kind of connective tissue. It helps attach this epithelium to underlying structures like muscles and bones, blood vessels and nerves, things of that nature. Okay, so here is a fiber. That's a fibrous part of a connective tissue. And you should probably know three different kinds of fibers from anatomy. What are three kinds of fibers that you learned about? Now let's do it in terms of strength. Collagen is one, that's the strongest one, like a Kevlar fiber or steel cable. Then we've got elastic, which is stretchy, and if you don't overstretch it and let go, it goes back to its original location, not as strong as collagen. And the third one is almost useless, and that is the reticular fiber. But it's used to hold some organs together, like the spleen. But since the reticular fibers are almost useless, you know that the spleen does not have a lot of integrity. It's easily traumatized as a result of that. Okay, so besides the fibers in this connective tissue, don't forget about the ground substance, which is like the jelly-like material that holds a lot of fluid. So it's a fluid compartment within this connective tissue. Okay, and you can tell this is a connective tissue because these cells that make it up are really far apart. And what do we call this big space between the cells? That is the matrix within the connective tissue, right? And what we just described were the two parts of a matrix, the fibrous part and also ground substance is a good way to characterize that in your mind. So here is a blood vessel, and I see fluid leaving, and we can say water is leaving this blood vessel going into this interstitial space. And from anatomy, you should be able to tell me what kind of blood vessel that is. It's very special. What kind of? It's a capillary, because only capillaries allow what? Exchange, right? Arteries and veins and arterioles and venules are way too thick to allow exchange to take place. So remember, a capillary is just a simple squamous epithelium that we see right here, and it makes this blood vessel, so we call that the endothelium. Okay, I think that describes this slide pretty well. Movement across a membrane. Okay, the plasma membrane is what we call selectively permeable. The plasma membrane is the membrane around a cell that separates it from the outside world. Everything inside the plasma membrane is our living processes. Okay, so the plasma membrane has a big job. It wants to bring in molecules to support life, and it wants to kick out harmful molecules out of the cell. So it's got a big job. And the plasma membrane will allow certain things to move through at certain times and not other things. And then at certain other times, it will then prevent that same material from moving across the membrane. So we say it is selectively permeable. Things that can't normally move through the cell membrane, but the cell needs, there are important transporters or proteins inserted in the membrane, and we call these transporters. There are different ways of transporting things. They're all proteins. Sometimes a molecule has to bind to a transporter before it's brought into the cell. Okay, we call that carrier-mediated transport. Right? But then sometimes it just has to be in the neighborhood, maybe within a pocket within that protein, and we call that non-carrier-mediated transport. And that is going to work by diffusion through membrane channels. All right, so what we see right here is that carrier-mediated transport usually involves energy, like ATP. Non-carrier-mediated transport does not require ATP. That's why we say it's diffusion. So diffusion doesn't require energy. These other processes do. But we're going to talk a lot more about that process. So we just talked about passive transport and active transport. It's really nice to break down transport into those two domains. All right, passive transport moves compounds down a concentration gradient, requires no energy. That's a really good definition. But let me expound on that. So in order for these molecules to move, there has to be an area someplace where there are a lot of molecules. There has to be a high concentration of some kind of molecule. And then in another location, there has to be a lower concentration. And if that is the case, high concentration, low, let me put my hands at different levels, then molecules will flow from that area of high concentration to an area of low concentration, all by themselves, and it doesn't require energy. Okay, and when the concentrations equalize, what happens to the motion of that molecule? When the concentrations equalize, there's no net transfer anymore. The process of diffusion stops because all we just said, right, there has to be a concentration gradient. And when the concentration gradient disappears, so does diffusion. Another pretty good example would be if I have a nice perfume bottle and I open it up, that perfume is fairly volatile. It will dissolve into the air and there'll be a really high concentration right around the mouth of the bottle. But what about the back of the room? Not unless you guys have that wearing that same perfume, and they're not. It's going to be what? It's going to be zero concentration. High concentration here, zero in the back of the room. What's going to happen to that perfume molecule? Even though we don't have a fan in here blowing anything around, what is that perfume molecule going to do? It's going to migrate its way all the way to the back of the room, and who's going to smell it first? Front row. Who's going to smell it second? Second row, right? Then third row. Then finally, all the way back in the room, not requiring any energy to get there. All right, so I'm going to forget to cap that perfume bottle, and we're going to come back next Tuesday, right, and we're going to keep all the doors closed. Is there any diffusion taking place in the room of that perfume molecule? And people are saying no, because we've given it enough time to get the concentration in the back of the room equal to the concentration in the front. So if you walk in that door, you smell a little bit of perfume. And walk in that door, a little bit of perfume, that one or that one, it's the same sense that you have, the same concentration. Okay, when the concentration is the same, what about movement of a perfume molecule or perfume molecules from here to way back there? It stops, right, because there's no gradient anymore. Okay, active transport, on the other hand, moves compounds against the concentration gradient. It certainly is allowed. Right, because if you have that perfume bottle, you have a super high concentration of perfume inside the bottle. Right, so that has to be an allowed process because somebody put all that perfume in there. But to get all that perfume in the bottle, guess what it required? Energy to do that. Right, that just doesn't happen automatically. Like if we came back 2 weeks from now and we left the perfume bottle open, that perfume wouldn't move back down into the bottle. You'd have to have some kind of machinery with what? Using energy to do that. Okay, so moves against the concentration gradient, requires energy, and transporters across the membrane. It needs certain kinds of proteins that will allow this to happen. All right, we got to define a solution. Some of you really know this. So what is a solution? It has two parts. It has two components. A solution is part solvent and part solute. All right, so let's discuss. What is a solvent? It's just the majority molecule that makes up this solution, and it's usually a liquid. Okay, and in us, what's the solvent for us?
Water.
Yeah, we're mostly made out of water. Okay, and a solute is just all the junk that is dissolved in that solvent. And can anybody name a solute in us? Yeah, sodium, ion. Glucose, we talked about that being in blood. Okay, all those little particles that are dissolved in the water inside of us are what we call solutes. So, what have you used as a solvent today? Has anybody used a solvent today for anything? I'm sure you have.
Water.
You did what? Water. Okay, so the solvent is water. So that's just a fancy way of saying, you know, what kind of water did you use today? What did you use that you needed water to make? Coffee, that's right, that's a really good example. Maybe tea, all right? So what have you used as a solvent today? Water, okay. What solutes did you use today? The coffee grounds, right, that dissolved into that water. Okay, and what's the major solvent in your body? Solvent, okay. Sodium would be the solute, would be the little particle, but the solvent would be water. Yep, that's the major solvent inside your body. And what are some important solutes in your body?
Sodium.
Yeah, sodium, potassium, glucose, any other kind of molecule, a nucleotide of some kind that dissolves in water. Okay. What's the minor solvent in your body? This is kind of a trick question. Okay. You have water. What's a totally opposite compound from water? Yeah, fats or lipids, right? And what can dissolve in a fat or a lipid? Nonpolar compounds, right? So polar compounds dissolve in the water compartment of your body, and nonpolar compounds dissolve in the lipids of our body. And we don't have a whole lot of lipid in our body. It makes a kind of a minor component, but you're going to see that there's some important physiology and regulation that takes place within these tiny, tiny lipid compartments. All right. All right, so we just answered this question. What can dissolve in this minor solvent? Anything that is nonpolar. And, well, let's give, what is an example of what can dissolve in a lipid? Let's put a whole bunch of triglycerides together. What else do you know of that you can drop on that whole bunch of triglycerides and it will just dissolve right into that solution? Any kind of fat, pick another one. Fatty acids, right? And cholesterol, any kind of steroid will just dissolve right in, which also means then that these things won't dissolve in water, right? Because it's just an opposite kind of molecule. Okay. So here we have some very nice pictures of diffusion. We have, let's just say this is a beaker that's filled with water. And we also put some solutes in this water. Okay, and so we can say these are little sodium atoms or ions. And we have a lot of sodium on the left, very low concentration on the right. And here we have a little wall that's separating these two components, but there are some pores in this that are big enough to allow sodium to move through. Okay, and sodium could move back and forth, but predominantly, which way is it going to go? And by what process? Yeah, it's going to go from left to right, down the concentration gradient. And if we wait a long time, you're going to have the same concentration on both sides, so what's going to happen to diffusion then? It's going to stop, right? Okay, and for instance, we're going to get to this, I'll wait until we get to it. Okay, diffusion. Nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane because the cell membrane is made out of a phospholipid. We're going to look at this pretty soon, and that lipid then prevents polar molecules from just freely moving back and forth, because polar molecules don't want to have anything to do with the inside of a membrane, which is just lipid, which is just polar molecules. All right. Some small molecules, maybe carbon dioxide and water, can move through water sometimes, depending on if the cell modifies the membrane. But oxygen and carbon dioxide can diffuse from high concentration to low right across this membrane very easily. Yeah. It is a form of passive. Diffusion is a form of passive transport because it requires no energy. Any kind of transport process that does not require energy is a passive process. And a good way to see that on most slides is you're going to look for some kind of drawing or mechanism. If it's an active process, guess what other molecule we want to draw in there? We want to look for ATP, and if ATP is broken down, then the cell is using that energy in ATP to make that motion happen, which means then it is an active process if it uses ATP. If it doesn't use ATP, then it's usually going to be called passive transport. Okay, so here we have oxygen in this extracellular environment, and we see that it's moving inside the cell. Why is it moving inside the cell? Because what's the concentration inside the cell? It's low. You think it should be high because your body needs oxygen to stay alive, but in order for oxygen to enter the cell, it has to be low compared to the extracellular fluid. And in order for oxygen to get into the extracellular fluid, what is the concentration in oxygen in this environment compared to the air that we're breathing? It's just a passive process. It's got to be high in the air, and lower in this extracellular fluid compartment, because otherwise oxygen wouldn't diffuse down that concentration gradient. And the reason why it gets into your cells is because there's a huge concentration gradient. It's low in your cells and high in the air we breathe, so it just goes down a concentration gradient. That's pretty nifty. What about CO2? That's a byproduct of keeping you alive. And it's pretty harmful. We want to get that out of our body. And it moves through a passive process of diffusion. That's right here, diffusion. So how does carbon dioxide move from what kind of concentration to another? From a high concentration to low concentration. Where you're saying, well, gee whiz, concentration of CO2 should be low in the cell because we're excreting it from our body. But it's just a passive process. The CO2 would be trapped in our bodies if the concentration in the air was the same as the concentration in the cell. The concentration of CO2 in our air is really close to zero. So it's a big concentration gradient. It's easy for our bodies to get rid of CO2. All right, so CO2 inside of our cells is just dying to get out in the air because there's a huge concentration gradient and it doesn't require any energy to do that. Okay, so what we have right here, let's analyze this slide a bit. Okay, you're familiar with these molecules. This is the phospholipid that you're familiar with. Here's the phosphate group. Here are the nonpolar tails. And you can see that a cell membrane has two of these layers put side to side. Here is the lipid region within the membrane, which is going to exclude polar compounds like sodium and chloride. Glucose is a nice polar compound. Water is polar. Okay, so it's going to exclude the motion of those molecules across it because of this region. So in order to get ions across, which are polar compounds, ions like to dissolve in water, there have to be channels. And these channels are proteins. Proteins are inserted into the membrane, and sometimes this channel is closed, like I see right here, and at other times it opens up. And we're going to look at that control mechanism in this class quite a bit. All right, so when this channel is closed, then these molecules can't diffuse down the concentration gradient, even though it's high concentration on the outside of the cell and low on the inside. These molecules are dying to get in, but they can't. They can't get across the cell membrane. All right, but now let's change this protein right here and open up the channel. Okay, and now these molecules can do what? Move down the concentration gradient, right, just by diffusion. And that does not require any energy because I don't see any ATP on this diagram. That's maybe a nice check. And here's the extracellular part. Here's the intracellular part. Sometimes when a channel can be closed or open, depending on what the cell wants, sometimes we call that a gated channel, right? And the opening and closing is of the gate, allowing for diffusion from high to low. Okay. So what is the diffusion, rate of diffusion equal to? It? How fast is diffusion occurring? Well, it's dependent on how big the concentration gradient is, for sure. Have you done this in lab yet? Have you looked at diffusion in lab? Okay, next week. Well, you're going to be able to do a really good job next week. Okay, so if the concentration gradient is large, diffusion is fast. If there's no concentration gradient, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It actually goes to zero, right? So it gets slower, 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 and then goes to zero. Diffusion is also partly controlled by the permeability of the membrane to that particular compound. So for instance, in this case, when this pore is closed, then this membrane has, what, zero permeability, right? And when it's open, then the membrane becomes a little bit more permeable to this particular compound. So that determines, helps determine the rate of diffusion. Also temperature, because temperature is just a measure of how fast molecules are buzzing around, vibrating, twisting, turning, and it's that motion that acts as a stirring rod that makes diffusion work. Okay, so all molecules are moving around, okay, microscopically, and as we increase the temperature, that vibration and twisting gets faster and faster and faster, which means that this, like, that's a stirring bar in solution. It just mixes things up faster. And so diffusion is faster when temperature is increased. And of course, when the membrane gets bigger, that allows for more diffusion to take place. The surface area of that particular membrane. And surface area just means a measure of, for instance, if we have an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper, the surface area of that piece of paper would be, what, 8.5 inches times 11, and then we know what the square inches are of that piece of paper. And as that piece of paper gets bigger and bigger and bigger, that's going to allow for more diffusion across that particular membrane. Okay, rate of diffusion is inversely related to molecular weight. And molecular weight just is a measure of the size of a molecule. Smaller molecules can move faster compared to big ones. And I think you should have an intuitive sense of that, okay? Because maybe you have a nice Honda motorcycle or a Harley, and you stop at a stoplight and you pull right next to a semi-tractor trailer, which is really, really long. The light turns green, who's going to move across the intersection first? The semi-tractor trailer or you on your motorcycle? Well, for sure on your motorcycle, because it's a lot lighter. It can move a lot faster initially than that truck can, right? Okay, so the bigger it is, the slower it moves. That's why it's inversely related. Okay, so we say directly related when these parameters increase, so does diffusion. It's directly related. If one increases, so does diffusion. If they all increase, then diffusion changes a lot in a positive sense. It gets bigger. All right, but if the molecular weight gets bigger, what happens to diffusion? Since it's inversely related, sort of like pH, it goes the opposite direction. Okay. So that's some things about diffusion. Osmosis is a passive process. And osmosis is just a special kind of diffusion. So if something's going to osmose, how does it have to move in terms of the concentration gradient? It's got to go from high to low. It can only move from high to low because it doesn't require any energy. All right, so there are three necessary criteria for a process to be considered osmosis. And when we're done talking about it, okay, you'll know what those three criteria are, or I'll go back to that first slide. Okay, so osmosis means that there has to be a net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. That is a really nice definition for osmosis. All right, so what's the molecule that's moving when we talk about osmosis in particular? Water. And water is what, solute or solvent? It's the solvent. So for osmosis, it always is going to be the solvent molecule. And in us, that just so happens to be water. Okay, so if it's not water that's moving, it can't be osmosis. It definitely has to be water in us. Okay, there's another criteria. And that is, if we look at this chamber right here, and I see a separation, I see a septum between these two chambers, right? And it's got some holes in it. So these holes are just big enough, right, for a water molecule to move across. That's what I see here. The small molecules are water, but these pores are small enough so that this molecule, which is a solute like a sodium or potassium, is way too big to get across the membrane. So this membrane right here is what we call selectively permeable or semi-permeable, the same thing. So in order for osmosis to take place, it's got to be the water molecule, and it's got to be through this selectively permeable membrane. If the membrane's not semi-permeable or selectively permeable, then it's not osmosis. Okay, the other thing is that it has to be diffusion. So what can you tell me about this water molecule? You already told me, but we'll go over it again. How is it moving? From high concentration to low. Okay, maybe the sodium would love to move from high concentration to low, but it can't. It's stuck over here, can't get across the membrane. All right, so osmosis only pertains to the water molecule, and it's a passive process, so it only can move by diffusion, and it has to go across a selectively permeable membrane. Those are the three criteria. So what about that perfume bottle that I opened up? It moved by diffusion, a passive process. Is that osmosis? No, because it wasn't a solvent molecule, wasn't water, and there was no membrane that it diffused through. Okay. So that is osmosis. Okay, cursor, where are you? Come back. Ah, here it is. Okay, when a solute cannot move across a membrane, we say it is osmotically active because it can't freely move across the cell membrane. So you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, why is that important? Because when we increase the solute concentration, we automatically decrease the water concentration as a result. So if we dump a whole bunch of salt and we get sodium and chloride over here, right, then that's going to draw even more water across the membrane. That's going to increase the rate of osmosis through this membrane right here just because we have more solute molecules. That's what we mean by osmotically active. And that's why glucose in your cells is stored as a big polymer, as glycogen, because if you had thousands of glucose molecules in here, then the water concentration would decrease so much that water would be drawn into it from that extracellular space, and when water is drawn in to such an extent, then the cell gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then sooner or later it's going to pop We call that lysis, right? But if we take all those thousands of glucose molecules and put them together as one molecule, then the water concentration inside the cell becomes the same on the outside, and the cell doesn't change shape. So that's another reason why glycogen is so cool. We talked about that a little bit, but now you sort of have a little sense in terms of physical chemistry. Okay, osmosis. Water diffuses down as concentration gradient, we know that, until it's equal on either sides. Some membranes, okay, most membranes are impermeable to water, but sometimes the cell will put special channels in, right, the cell membrane so that water can actually pass through. And those channels are what we call aquaporins. And I'll talk about aquaporins in a couple months. All right, so I won't talk about them a lot from here on out in the course. But when we get to the urinary system, that's really important because that's one of the reasons or how we can produce urine and regulate the concentration of water in our urine by these aquaporins right here. All right, so let's look at this channel. It has a bunch of aquaporins in it, and it looks like we got a solvent molecule, got solvent molecules, namely water, and some solutes, and the solutes are represented by these dark dots. I don't see a key on this diagram, okay, but these are the solute molecules, and the solute molecule is glucose. All right, so we dump some glucose into this side, and we dump a little bit of glucose on the other side, and as a matter of fact, half of the amount of glucose compared to the first side, the side over here on the right. So the concentration on the right for glucose is twice that on the left, which also means then that water, right, where there's low glucose concentration, we have a high concentration of solvent, a high concentration of water. On this side, a low concentration on the right. All right, and we're only talking about osmosis right here. So what is this water molecule going to do? Move down its concentration gradient through this selectively permeable membrane because glucose can't get across. All right, so it's going to go from the left chamber into the right chamber. Is this osmosis taking place? And why is that? Because it's the water molecule. It's moving down a concentration gradient passively. It doesn't require any energy. And what can you tell me about this membrane? Selectively permeable. If you want to say semi-permeable, that's fine with me, but they're both about as long as each other when you write it down. Okay? I don't see an advantage one way or the other. All right, so these are the initial conditions. And then if we wait, actually a relatively short period of time, but let's wait over the weekend, water is going to move into this chamber over here, and guess what happens to this partition? It gets shifted over to the left because all that water moved over into this compartment. And since we waited all weekend, what's the concentration of solute on the right chamber compared to the left chamber right now? It's going to be equal. And what's the water concentration? It's going to be equal, right? And when they're equal, then osmosis stops because osmosis is just diffusion. And when diffusion stops or osmosis stops, what can you tell me about the movement of this membrane right here? It stops too, right? It's not going to be moved one way or the other. Okay, so the pressure that is developed within the right-hand chamber to move this membrane over is what we call osmotic pressure. Okay, and osmotic pressure is built up by osmosis, which means that there has to be a selectively permeable membrane. These solute molecules then are osmotically active because they can't get through, and water is going to move down its concentration gradient, maybe inside the cell or to outside the cell. All right, so that's a pretty good figure. Okay, so the force that's necessary to prevent motion of this membrane right here really is what we call osmotic pressure. But I think you should have a pretty good sense of how that is, how that happens. Okay, let me just look at the next slide really quick. Okay, let's define how we can make a solution up. What are the two parts of a solution? The solute and the solvent, right? And let's just think about water, because that's what we're really interested in. So here we have a flask. Does anybody know what kind of flask that is? I forgot. Erlenmeyer flask. Ooh.